Okay, I want to welcome everybody to House of Finance. It's 2:30 Monday, May 2nd. For the record, we have Representative Holmes, Representative Kelly, Chairman Chenault, Representative Hawker, Representative Weirach, Representative Jewell, Representative Croft, and myself, Co-Chairman Meyer. Today we'll be taking up, I had a list here, Senate Bill 147, Senate Bill 16, Senate Bill 139, and SJR 11. We do need to take up this little bill here again, Senate Bill 141. We're going to address the fiscal analysis of the actions we took on that yesterday. We don't have the numbers yet. That information is being prepared, and it'll probably be a while yet. So if you're here for that, it'll be at least another hour before we have that information and before we take up SB 141 again.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On that, I hope we're getting at least the numbers that we changed, so the 4.5 to 5 and the 1.75 to 2.5, both what that'll cost and some justification of why we did that. I mean, why was it 1.75 and 2.5? And is that some indication of whether that's going to be sufficient or not for to pay medical cares and retirement, cost of retirement? And so there's all kinds of issues there of what the impact of those change numbers are, and something better than just, well, somebody had 3 and somebody had 2 and we did 2.5. What they mean and what they do. And then the second was Representative Weirach's good amendment on putting death and disability back in the old system. I want to understand what that costs now broken out. It used to be paid in the entire PERS obligation, so where that's paid for under this bill. Those two items, I think, are vital for us.
I represent Kelly. Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I think we need to be careful that we're back to address the issue of the report and the fiscal note, not to re-debate the amendments that we went through yesterday.
Whether you go from 3.0 to 3.5, I think those are more policy calls that we just decided yesterday. Now we need to see what the fiscal impact is of the decisions we made yesterday. I think that's what the report is going to indicate to us.
Yeah, I'm not offering any more amendments or reiterating them. I'm just, at the very least, the Finance Committee ought to understand whether the numbers we selected without any fiscal justification yesterday overfund or underfund people's pension. And either, you know, we want to have some idea that it's about right. If we're saving too much for them, that's paying more now than we need to. If we're not saving enough for them, they're not going to have a retirement they can live off of. And so we got to at least know that we're in the ballpark on those. And similar on medical costs. If we're giving them a bunch more in their medical account than they need, that's not very wise of us fiscally. If we're giving them a lot less, it's not going to be very competitive. So I promise there won't be any amendments on it. It's just some idea of what we did over and over.
Yes, I believe that's the intent of the retirement folks. Melanie Milhorn. Yeah, Ms. Milhorn is running as we speak. Okay, so one other housekeeping item. There was a request to legal services as to whether or not we need to declare conflict of interest at the committee level. And let me just read this. The question was, is a member of a legislative committee required to declare conflict if a bill before the committee for a vote addresses a matter that would cause a member to declare a conflict before voting on the floor? And we got pretty much a typical legal answer. It just says that rules of procedure at the committee level are less formal than on the floor. However, to the extent that they fit within the context of a committee meeting, the uniform rules apply to committee meetings. Therefore, a committee member may request to abstain from voting on a bill in a committee due to a conflict of interest, but is not required to do so. If it is established practice to do so on the floor, such a motion is appropriate at the committee level as well. So what I'd like to do,
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Will this legislation affect the existing plans of any of us?
I don't know. Really, I don't think this has anything to do with
this. I mean, that's, there might be a conflict if there's.
Representative Ward.
Thank you for requesting the opinion, Mr. Chairman. I read that as you may or may not. You may or you may not. And if you feel like you have to do it, you can do it. It's become a tradition on the floor to do it, but I think that you're not even required to do it on the floor. And so the word required is not in my lexicon with respect to dealing with conflict votes on bills before us. I haven't declared a conflict on bills before us, even though I may have, but I'm not required to legally, and I'm not going to start doing it. And I don't think the chair has required members to start doing it before or after this opinion. So I'm going to continue my practice of not declaring a conflict in this committee.
Actually, Representative Weirich, what I was going to ask of the committee, if there's not any objections, is that we not require a member to declare a conflict of interest at the committee level. But certainly, you should do so at the floor level. If there's some objection to that, let's discuss it.
I request permission to still feel conflicted.
You can feel conflicted. All right.
Okay. Well, or all the time.
All the time.
And again, if somebody does feel strong enough and want to declare it at the committee level, that's fine. And I guess the ruling here with the committee's concurrence is that it's not required. Okay, very good. No objection to that, then that will be our practice for the next 7 days. Okay, today we're taking up Senate Bill 147, sport fish facility bond surcharges. We have Senator Seekins with us here to introduce the bill to us. Is there a companion bill with this? Is that yours?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Okay. House bill, I believe, is 252.
252, yep.
Yeah, we heard it, Mr. Chairman, in House Fisheries, Subcommittee of Fisheries, and House Resources, and passed both. And so the bills are companion. They're both identical, as far as I know.
So is it safe to say you like this bill, then?
I do like it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just anecdotally and not on point, my conflict of interest rule has always been no conflict, no interest. Let's get back to Senate Bill 147, and I do represent Representative Holm has been a great help. We worked on this concept together to solve a problem that both of us saw and that our communities saw across the state. And basically, this act is to provide for some sport fishing facility surcharge to be able to enhance, to reconstruct and construct new sport fish hatcheries across the state, and as I'll mention a little bit later, also to enhance or to expand the recreational fishing opportunities in both the northern and southern and southeast by some additional enhancements down in the southeast. We have an ever-growing demand for fish stocks in Alaska, and we have more people want to fish. Resident populations are growing, tourist demand for recreational opportunity is increasing, and at the same time, sport fish production is decreasing. Alaska's only sport fish hatcheries for the Department of Fish and Game are located in Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base. Both of those are more than 30 years old, and they're nearing the ends of their useful lives. To make matters worse, biomass production will soon plummet, and because hatcheries require warm water to enhance the growth of baby fish, and we are going to lose waste heat from Fort Richardson and Elmendorf power plants that has provided that energy for many years in October of this year. They're both going to be shutting down their hot water production at that time. And as a result, biomass production will suffer greatly at the same time that demand is increasing. And we can fix this problem and plan for years to come. And Senate Bill 147 and Representative Holmes' companion bill provide for the renovation and expansion of the Fort Richardson and Elmendorf facilities to meet the South Central needs, and furthermore, it provides for a new fish hatchery in Fairbanks to meet the demands of the interior regions. Currently, hatchery fish are trucked from Richardson into the interior for planting up there. Now, this won't be cheap, but it is affordable, and federal funds have been procured to meet some of that that demand. Senator Stevens has been kind enough when we talked with him and we pointed out that the increased demand, some of that increased demand is due to military expansion in the state, and that there also are some environmental problems that we can help cure in the Fairbanks area by using hot water from the Chena 5 power plant downtown and take some of the BTUs out of that water before it's discharged back into the river, and that we can at the same time be able to enhance some educational facilities with the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and provide for some visitor facilities for school kids to come by and take a look and see baby fish grow and some of the other things that go along with that. Senator Stevens was able, we've gotten over $6 million, and we're $6.5 million. We're anticipating by the time he's completed with his grants, we'll be at about $10 million to offset some of that. But anyhow, what happens is we now will build a new fish hatchery building in Elman and Richardson, and we will then also put into that same hatchery facility a salmon module that will provide for about 95% of the fish that come out of there will go to sport fish, sport fishermen, and that really what it does, the whole thing allows us to convert fishing into catching, which is what my grandsons tell me they want to do when they go fishing with grandpa. They like going fishing, but they'd much rather be catching. And it's for us to do nothing is absolutely not an acceptable option, and we're behind the curve now. We probably should have rung the bell on this a year or two ago to be up to the curve, but we did not. So with this passage of Senate Bill 147, we can avoid the disaster that we see coming. We can satisfy some current needs. We can provide modern facilities that can be expanded for years to come. And we're looking at the facilities being able to be expandable for up to 20-25 years from today. Once the surcharge is, the bonding the mechanism to pay for this is paid off, the surcharge goes away. And every dollar that comes in will be used to pay down the indebtedness that we're incurring. So also, as I mentioned earlier, some of this goes into Southeast as well. This is truly a statewide effort. We're trying to solve all these issues for folks like me who belong to the fillet and release class rather than the catch and release class. And that would be the Crystal Lake Hatchery in Wrangell's Petersburg. We'll have some $2.5 million that will be injected into keeping those facilities up and some enhancements there. The Sitka Haynes Hatchery, about $1.5 million, and the Skagway Hatchery, about $1.6 million. So all told, we're planning for every place except where Reggie Jewell is, Representative Jewell is out there, and we took a look at the fishing license sales, and less than 0.4% of all the licenses sold in the state of Alaska come from that part of the state. Not that they don't fish, Representative Jewell.
You use nets.
But the basically, this is designed to be a statewide program, and I think it does accomplish that goal, Mr. Chairman. And I'm willing to answer any questions. We have folks here from the Department of Fish and Game that can answer any questions you have as well.
Okay, thank you, Senator Seekins. Any questions?
One,
Representative Chenault. For the record, Representative Stokes and Representative Moses have joined us. Representative Chenault.
Yeah, Senator Stevens, where do they deposit these fish after they're reared in the hatchery? You spoke a couple different places.
Well, in the interior, where I'm most familiar with the Chenault, they go into the lakes and streams in the interior. They also go down to Kodiak Island. Hundreds of thousands live in Kodiak Island. They come down into the Kenai Peninsula, all through South Central, all the way out to the Glen Allen area, all across. Pretty much wherever they can get access, they're planting these fish now.
Well, I was just curious. I'd like to see us get more up in that valley, and maybe that would keep some of those guys up there instead of coming to.
I think you know I could probably assure you that Representative Stoltz would stay up in the Mad Valley if you provide more fish for him.
That's indeed crux behind the bill.
Okay, it's a good thing I'm sitting between you two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Seaton. It's such a seat here. Just on the issue of license fees, the thing I heard the most from fish and game employees in my district is on the game side, and that was to do necessary research. And did you at all look at that?
Yes, I did, Representative Stoltz, through the chair. That's where we have a Senate Bill 170 that's in the Resource Committee in the Senate right now, looking at that, and we have made a decision between Chairman Wagner and myself to hold some public hearings across the state in the interim to be able to address people's concerns and also to get the feel of those folks that would contribute to the Fish and Game Fund with their hunting licenses fees, what kind of controls they would like to see put on those additional funds that come in terms of the application. And you would probably directly look at the Title 16 under diversion of the Fish and Game Fund. Folks are telling me that they do not have a problem increasing hunting licenses fees if they have a greater opportunity to be able to bring something home. If they're going to have an increase in their license fee and they still don't get to bring something home, they're not too enthralled about it. So I'm anticipating that we'll have some coordinated meetings throughout the interim in different parts of the state to be able to address that. And they don't have a problem also if they want to put the money up, as long as they feel there's a level of accountability as to where that money goes. And we're working on that with the department.
Paul?
Yeah,
go ahead.
One of the entities that's shown some support for this measure is the Advisory Board, but they had emphasized in their written comments, they used a figure of $5 that they supported unanimously. Did you give that serious consideration? And I see they're about the only game advisory board that's in the packet here.
I did, Representative Coles, through the chair. I looked at what we did was we basically had to go and say, okay, the mechanism that works here is we have to deposit into the Fish and Game Fund enough to pay off the bonded indebtedness. We initially came up with a number of around $7.50. Then we added in, you'll see the additional $5.5 million that went into Southeast, and that made that $8.50 number start to work. And that was I planned that in there. Being an old used car salesman, I start a little higher than I might want to accept, you know. But in this case, because of the additional $5.5 million that we put in there, it came down to that number really covered what the expenditures would be. And as part of the bonding agreement, we need to deposit enough into the Fish and Game Funds to pay it off. I really would have liked to have used just a capital expenditure to be able to do this, but we all know that probably would not have gotten very far. So this is a user pay, user benefit program. It's committed, all the money that comes in is committed to pay off the indebtedness, and as soon as the indebtedness is paid off, the surcharge goes away. That's why it's a surcharge rather than an increase in fishing fees.
Sure, I guess we'll get to see if I can lowball a dealer here, but I might have a different number. But there was just one other. So I noticed there was legislation that passed, the naming legislation, that would be one of the facilities.
Yes, that passed the Senate today. That was introduced by Representative Ramirez. It would name the Fairbanks facility after Ruth Burnett, former mayor up there, formerly aide to Senator Stevens up there, very involved, great humanitarian, and a great representative of what a community member should be.
Well, I have a lot of admiration for my friends in the interior. I knew Mayor Burnett when she. I was thinking that maybe we could have a subtitle. So we can call this act the Seekins Home Surcharge, and we can put in another license.
I would be willing to carry that cross if my grandchildren can catch more fish.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Weber.
Senator Seekins, were you going to be here or do you have to leave? Because I had an amendment I wanted to talk to you. If you had to leave, I wanted to talk to you about it now. If you're going to be here, we can talk about it when I have the amendment.
I do have another commitment, but I can make myself available for this committee on request, and it's not a problem.
Can I just address the issue?
Sure, go ahead.
What the amendment does is, the only complaints I've been getting about this bill is the 50 cents that people have to carry around in their pocket when they charge for licenses. And I had talked to you about this a couple of weeks ago in Representative Holm, that the amendment I had simply moves it around so the net effect is zero, but the rounding to whole numbers. And the only, it sort of reduces some and increases some, the non-resident one-day sport fishing license a de minimis amount. I just wonder if you had a negative reaction to that, because the net effect is it just keeps you people from carrying quarters around in their pocket on some boats when they have to do get these charter licenses on the boats. And that's, those are all the yelling I was getting. Otherwise, everybody from Southeast I talked to supported this bill.
Being a used car salesman, I would have made it $8.95. But I would say that I think we might run the risk because of the extra five if we reduced it down to eight of not being able to fully fund the bond issue, and I could ask the folks who've been working on that to make sure that was the case. I don't think anyone would object to raising it to nine without jeopardizing the bond issue process. And I would, you know, if it would deflect anybody's heat in order to make sure we did it right, I'd even take the blame for it for that. But if you wanted to round it off, I don't have a problem with it being rounded off. We would just have to take a look at the effect on the fiscal notes and the ability to pay down that bond and the commitments we have to the bonding agency.
So as long as the amendment didn't tinker with that but rounded it to whole numbers, is that all right with you?
That doesn't bother me at all.
Okay, thanks.
I'm willing to accommodate you guys, however. We just don't want to screw up the bonding authority.
Okay, yeah, very, very good. We'll ask the bonding folks when this amendment comes up. So there's another amendment that does something similar, only actually still keeps the quarters, I guess. Just reduces everything down a dollar. And I don't know if you're still planning on making that amendment.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
After talking with the department and with Senator Seekins, I had an amendment to move it down to 750, but I withdrew that.
So. All right. Okay. So in that case, then we'll. Be your amendment is all I know about currently, and then we'll address that later. And we have the senator's concerns or feelings about that. Okay, any other questions for Senator Seekins?
Okay, thank you very much for your the opportunity to present this bill.
Okay, thank you. We do have, and your staff will be staying around, is that correct?
Yep,
okay, sure. Right. Jim Preston with here in Juneau. And we do have several people available for questions. Kelly Heffler, Devin Mitchell with the bonding, Gordon Garcia. Okay, Jim.
Thank you. My name is Jim Preston. I live here in Juneau. I am one of the charter operators that Representative Wyrock mentioned. I'm also a vendor, meaning that I sell licenses and stamps and whatnot. I'm here to request that Representative Wyrock does present his amendment and you take it up. It's not a huge burden. People have been trying to make light of it, but as soon as I raised the objection when this came out, but we're talking about quarters. We're talking about out on a boat, not in a sports shop where many of you from Fairbanks and Anchorage go buy your licenses. We're talking about out on the boat where we don't have cash registers and whatnot. And when I started looking at it, and I went to the department, I said about how many non-resident licenses, because that's what we down here in Southeast mostly sell as the non-resident, and they said it was in the neighborhood of 50,000. Well, in 50,000 of them, most of which are being sold on charter boats throughout, like Sitka and Ketchikan, Juneau, Skagway, and whatnot. Well, that's 100,000 quarters. That's a lot of extra change that has to be carried around and handled by folks like me who are being vendors to provide a service. And, you know, we don't get a benefit from it other than the fact that we're providing that service and it's less time for our clients to get their licenses. They don't have to go up to the store that's up at the top of the dock if there is one. So I certainly would request that you not that you make the amendment and put it to the nearest whole dollar. A year ago, if you recall, I was amongst the group that was coming around talking about the guide licensing bill, and amongst other things, as we were talking after that passage, I was talking to members from the Sportfish, and we talked about the possibility of the increases of licenses, of which this is a substitute for, and I support that, the concept of this. And when we were talking about that, there seemed to be an agreement and an understanding that if it was whole dollar amounts, that certainly makes it a lot better for those of us vendors that are out in the field doing our providing licenses to our clients. Again, if you're in a grocery store or a Fred Meyer or whatnot, you have access to a lot of change already, so it's not a big deal. But for us that are out there, it is kind of a burden. And as one of the folks from Fish and Game said, but Jim, you only had 200 licenses last year. Well, that's true. I had about that many, I guess. I was truncated at the end of July. I didn't even get to operate in August and September. But still, 200 licenses at 50 cents per license for change is 400 quarters, which means that I would have to be able to deal with that, which isn't a whole big deal. I mean, you know, on the one hand, it's not a big deal, but on the other hand, you know, I'm providing the service for you all to collect this money and for my clients to pay this money. So if you round it off, it should be better. And otherwise, I support the whole concept of this, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Preston. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for joining
thank
us this
you.
Afternoon. Okay, yes.
Next question, Mr. Mitchell.
Okay, can we hold off until we finish the question? Okay. Ricky Geese.
Yes.
River Sport Fishing.
Yes, hi. My name is Ricky Geese, Executive Director of Kenai River Sport Fishing. We would just like to voice our support for this bill. We believe that it is very necessary to upgrade our hatcheries here. Over the next decade in South Central, we're expecting to have an increase of about 60,000 anglers. And those new anglers need to have opportunities that are diverse and spread out through the region. And the hatchery fish in the Stock Lakes program that ADFNG Sport Fish Division does really fills that need that we see here. The Kenai River already is the state's most popular fishing river for Chinook, sockeye, and coho. And although we like the growth in the industry, it does need to be spread out. We support the surcharge on the sport users and agree that once the surcharge, once the bond is paid off, that the surcharge should go away. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay, we do have some questions, Mr. Geese. Representative Silk.
Thank you, Mr. Geese. I guess just hypothetically, implementing this this legislation, the hatcheries, or say limiting the number of set nets, which would provide more angler opportunities in short and long run?
That's an interesting question. We'd have to run through the numbers. I don't. If we're dealing with hypothetics, then maybe instead of an either or, how about a both and?
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Hey, Ricky, would you have any comment? You've probably been listening on the amendment to either raise to $9 or lower to $8 the cost of this program to get rid of the quarters. Do you have any comments on that?
No, I think it's a valid issue, and just to make it easier for people who implement the plan, we would have no heartburn in either direction. Whatever the numbers shake out, I do believe that it's important to deal in whole numbers and not require people thinking around with change a lot.
All right, thanks for your thing, Mr. Schnell.
Okay, thank you, Representative Schnell. Any other questions for Mr. Geese? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's all I have to testify. Is there anyone else? Lorelei Carter? No? Okay. All right, then we'll go ahead and close testimony. Take up amendments. just for the record, we do have Amendment 1, Representative Kelly. What was your wish on that, to withdraw it?
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Amendment 1 is withdrawn. Amendment 2, Representative Warwick.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Amendment 2.
Yeah, object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if Devin Mitchell could come in.
Mr. Mitchell. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things the sponsor of the bill talked about is not wanting to mess up the bonding relationship between the fees that are charged for these licenses and the amount that the amendment would change it to. The net effect of the amendment is zero. And I just wanted to get some testimony on the record whether it's problematic to adopt this amendment and whether it affects the bonding scheme.
And for the record, if you tell us who you are and
Devin Mitchell, State Debt Manager in the Department of Revenue, through the Chair, Representative Wyrock. The fiscal note that the Department of Revenue submitted contemplated a 20-year level debt service and a 5.5% true interest cost, which, as the Chair and the Chair's staff might recall in other proposals, is an above market interest rate. And so we already have flexibility built into the bill, and the a zero impact, of course, is going to be very easy to manage, and even a slight negative is manageable in the numbers that are contemplated in the bill right now.
Thank you for your testimony.
Can I ask?
Representative Kropp, go ahead.
I think the numbers are slightly positive, but maybe I'm missing something. The amendment changes three of the resident from 850 to 8, losing so 50 cents on each, and the numbers we have on the sheet here are that there are 115, 44, and then 60, so about 165 total of those combined licenses sold in 03. So it cost you about $80,000 there, 160,000 licenses, and you lost 50 cents from the proposal. And then the non-resident one day, there were 109 of those, 1,000 of those sold in 03. And if you're upping them by $1.50, then that raises about $160,000. So I think this is to the positive, about $80,000 or $90,000. Those numbers sound right, or you have the sheets as well. I don't think this is a negative, and I do think it even helps a little bit.
Through the chair, Representative Kropp, I haven't been examining Fish and Game's numbers as far as the impacts of the fees in end-of-day revenue. However, if there were a slight positive impact, the intent of the sponsor was that the term of the leveraging would be reduced. So,
you just pay it off quicker.
That's correct.
And a couple more. It surprised me to learn, and maybe I should have always known, really the only sport fish hatcheries we have are in Fairbanks, and then they're the Anchorage stocking comes from those Fairbanks hatcheries?
I think it's the other way, through the chair, Representative Kropp. That's a Fish and Game question, but I believe it's the other way around.
Okay.
Save that question.
I'll save it.
Okay. Representative Hawker.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Devin, I think I'm going to segue off a comment you made there. Was it your understanding that the intent of the sponsor is that should there be any additional revenue generated from these surcharges, that it would be dedicated, which we of course can do since our revenue bonds, to early retirement of the underlying debt?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, there is an operating component in Fish and Game's fiscal note. Other than the amount that might be in their fiscal note, it was the intent, from my understanding.
This is not a trick question.
Yes, that there would be an acceleration of the repayment of the bonds, and so rather than having a 20-year schedule, you would shift to a 17-year schedule.
So to that end, I would observe we had also earlier testimony, the previous telephonic testifier, mm-hmm. and I think we had the sponsor testify that in lieu of going, you want to go to 8, you want to go to 9, you go to 9. In this case, I think for the small price of a 50-cent increase in the surcharge, the law of numbers and the compounding value of that, I'd be as comfortable instead of this shuffle within, just raising the 850s to 9 across the board here. just for the committee's thoughts, sir.
Okay.
Mr.
Chairman, one additional thought that might dovetail with Representative Parker's suggestion is that if you look at the fish and game license fee collection history, it's been growing. There have been increased numbers of fishing licenses issued over the last 20 years. And in the contemplation of this undertaking, they didn't try to extrapolate out that growth trend into the future. And so the amounts that are suggested would be raised by the fee implementation are based on current numbers rather than projected numbers. Mm-hmm. And so that's an additional means whereby this is a conservative.
So the theory being we make more fish and we have more fishermen and we collect more money. Thank you.
Representative Barber?
Mr. Chairman, if there's a friendly amendment on this, I'd just have it come from Representative Holm, since it's more or less he's sort of the companion. The other thing is I'm all in favor of early retirement of state debt to the extent we can do it, and if it does it, then I'm for it. But I don't care. My concern is the 50-cent issue, I approve of what Representative Hawker's giving me, but I just assume Representative Holm. I sort of need to take my leave from you, whatever you want to do.
And I would note that I did not offer an amendment.
No.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I will offer a friendly amendment if it pleases the chair.
Okay.
To go to 9. I think 9 is probably a better number to go with, and that way we don't impact the ability to get the bonds. And actually, I think $10 is fine number for the non-resident as well. I don't think that affects at all. Let me just offer you something here. I was looking through, Mr. Chairman, I was looking through the fishing licenses throughout the United States, and I just would like to make the comment that $24 were right around New Jersey, and I just would suggest that it's a little bit nicer to fish off the banks of the Alaskan rivers than it is on the Newark Bridge. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Holm, did you move an amendment to the amendment?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman,
and was that
probably not very well?
I'll restate it.
Oh, okay, Representative Barber can restate it for you. Is that all right?
Certainly.
I understand the amendment to the amendment number 2 is on line 23 to delete 850 and insert 9. On line 24, delete 850, insert 9. Line 25, delete 850, insert 9. And line 29, delete 850, insert 10. That's not an amendment to the amendment, but that's what the amendment would do.
Thank you, Representative Weiler.
Okay, yes, Representative Holmes' amendment to the amendment.
I have no objection.
I'll object.
Okay.
I'll object
for comment. Okay. Substantively.
Okay. We do have some objections. Representative Stoltz.
I guess the best way to stay out of debt is not go in the first place, so that's the thing. I'm not going to debate the bill right now, so I'll save it.
Okay, very good. Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking, we were concerned about what the impact is on under the proposed current license sold in 03. Under the current proposal, which is the 850, the total income off of those four particular items dealing with Amendment 2 would be $2.337 million. Under Representative Wyrock's Amendment 2, the income off of those would be $2.419 million. So there would be an increase under Amendment 2, if my numbers are right, of a little less than $100,000, about $80,000 difference.
Is that the amendment to the
amendment? No, that is the current amendment as drafted. If we go to $9, I can run those numbers for you if you want me to, but it would, instead of the 2.3, which is what is currently proposed, now I'm going to guess that would probably take it up to 2.6, 2.8 million. So it would be considerably more than what the proposed bill does now.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to point out that if you were looking to have whole dollars, there was a couple of other license 850s on line 1 and 2, page 4.
Yeah, well, those, Mr. Chairman?
Page 4. I'm sorry. Okay. One and two on page four. Is that what you said, Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Okay.
On those, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Croft.
It's non-resident military sport, fishing, and small game, and they're relatively small numbers. I mean, you could go either way, but it's not going to be, you know, what we've heard testimony about is the 100,000 people that come up and get a one-day sport, non-resident sport fishing license, and that's the biggest number on here except the resident sport fishing. The non-resident military is only 4,000, and the non-resident military fishing and small game is only 254. So you could, but it's not the big driver. And on the reason I objected, if I can just continue and we don't have to come back. I mean, you're asking people to pay more on their fishing and combination licenses, and I think we have to directly relate it to funding these hatcheries, which I want to learn more about when we get back to the bill and get Fish and Game up here. But to simply take what $850 is an about appropriate amount to do the bonds, to go over that, while it's only 50 cents, so we might pay it off earlier or whatever, I think I should stick to the lower numbers rather than raising them. If you're at 850 and you want to make it round, I'd rather lower it than raise it. And with this amendment, we know we're at least as good as we were before. Fiscally, we're a little better. It'll pay them off in a fine amount of time. And I guess I wanted to ask somebody, Law, if Law is here, or Fish and Game, if they could, whether there are any Carlson case applications. I don't think so. I think the Carlson case had to do with what the differences are for a commercial fishing license, and I think we have much freer rein to discriminate, if you will, against non-residents on sport fishing. But I wanted to at least ask that.
Sorry. Yeah, I don't show anybody available from legal. So I don't know if we can answer that question.
There's somebody.
Oh, okay. We do have somebody. Tell us who you are, sir, and for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kelly Hepler. I'm the Director of Division of Sport Fish with Fish and Game. And I'm sorry if I missed the question. Senator Seekins and I were in a sidebar conversation. Okay. So
it's a legal question, but we'll let you take a shot at it, Representative Croft.
In this setting different rates and this different surcharge for non-resident versus resident, are there any Carlson case issues, or do we have a lot more leeway in sport fishing licenses than we do in commercial fishing licenses?
Through the chair, Carlson case refers to commercial uses. These are not commercial uses, so the ratios we're presently proposing right now are the same ratios basically we have right now. So we have if you go back and look and see what the fees are compared to resident fees, the ratio we're talking about increasing about the same. It's around 77% of our funds from non-residents now. Proposing take up about 80%. So we've asked Department of Law, so no consideration here whatsoever with that.
The truck is coming by. You've asked Department of Law, and they said
there is not a problem. The Carlson case does not apply here.
Mr. Croft, did you have some other questions you want to ask?
Well, I guess I'm the only one here who doesn't know this, but so the Fairbanks hatcheries supply the state with the stocking? I mean, they tell me how that works. Where are the hatcheries and where do they stock, and are there regional ones?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, right now there's two hatcheries. One's located at Fort Richardson, the other's Clayton and Elmendorf. Those two hatcheries provide all the stocking we see between Homer all the way up across in the Alaska Range. Now, there previously was a hatchery at Clear Air Force Base up in Fairbanks back in the 90s. And that got closed down, and the production then got moved down to Fort Richardson. What's being proposed is a new hatchery in Fairbanks to take care of the interior needs by themselves. Then we're also going to then refurbish the hatchery, build a hatchery at Fort Richardson to take care of all the needs south of the Alaska Range down into Kodiak. Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I don't want to stray too far from the amendment of the bill, but I want to use the economy of these guys.
Sure, that's fine. That's fine.
Just, I guess one of I have the financial question. How many? I couldn't find it. The tables here. How long is this anticipated to be a surcharge for anglers?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, in the fiscal bill or fiscal note. With the numbers that we contemplated, it would be a 20-year leveraging, but as I stated earlier, those were pretty conservative based on today's interest rate. And so while we had a 5.5% interest rate in the bill, we believe we could achieve something less than that in today's market. We recently did a public corporation issuance on some A-rated paper that was insured to AAA, and the true interest cost wound up being just over 4%, so about 4.1%, 4.5%. So we would anticipate, if it were issued today, being in that same range. How that correlates to term, I don't have that here in front of me, but I would imagine that we would be able to shorten term, as I stated a few minutes ago, maybe into the 17-year range, and perhaps even shorter than that.
Just on the same issue, since I've got a bunch of school needs in the Mad Valley, and we're trying to figure out how to strip down to the very basic needs, and I've heard these described as some pretty elaborate designs that the Convention and Visitor Bureau, the tourist folks are all excited about it. It seems Mayor Whitaker has these different visions. Can we strip this thing down to the bare sport fishing need essentials, or do it? Just disabuse me of these pollutions in my mind that I've been getting from the critics.
Through the chair, Representative Stultz. Let's start with the hatchery in Fort Rich first. Fort Rich Hatchery is located on an Army base, so there's no practical public access in that base. That facility will be your production facility. There will be nothing fancy about that facility whatsoever. You can take anybody out there, and they're not going to see it. It's a visitor center, at least not one you probably want to go visit a lot, but it's truly a working facility. Then we move up to Fairbanks, and there's been different discussions of what kind of a facility we need up there. We're building a production facility, period. Okay. On top of that, there's been some other money associated with that could make the facility more pleasing to the eye, not meant to be a visitor center. All we're trying to do is have this thing accessible so members of the public want to feel welcome to come in and have the kids come in to look at it. We're talking also about putting some housing up at Fort Richardson, the same as we have the same kind of housing up at Fairbanks. If you want to answer some of that, Gordon Garcia probably needs to introduce yourself so you can answer that.
My name is Gordon Garcia, Representative Stultz through the chair. When we first approached the Fairbanks facility, it was basically, let's bring everything in, make it a visitor-friendly type of facility, meet our production needs, and in fact, kind of make it pretty. The $25 million price tag kind of put everybody back on their heels. And so we went back and took out a lot of the fluff and got those costs down to something that would be essentially covered by the amount that we would appropriate from this bill, the license fees. And then the $10 million will take care of some of the other pretty, so to speak. We would have an I&E center there, and perhaps even a lab for the University of Fairbanks as kind of a cooperative with them.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add just one comment, that the Representative Stoltz's question about school funding versus this funding, since we have here a revenue structure that we can take advantage of, in as much as we have a dedicated fund, that these fee collections, they're not going to cross over into educational needs.
I understood that.
Yeah. So, but I understand your conceptual question.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll just put on the record. I look at facilities in this political jurisdiction I have in this sports living room. There's huge facilities that have, like the Performing Arts Center that we've been paying on, and we paid on for. I don't want to have an angler surcharge paying for a light show or something. I want to put these things on the record. I know I've got some conservative friends in the interior. They're not into the bells and whistles, but I've sure heard a lot of, there's some grand ideas that come out of some sections of the interior, and that's if some of that is filtered to me and that's not accurate, I guess we've had the benefit of this committee process, the first time I've got to hear the bill to hopefully dispel those, it bothers me that that's what we started out at, and trying to, but it's, I'm glad the process has had some discipline to cut that back, and
If it means an extra 7 years of pain, I'd be screaming bloody murder for somebody's light show. I heard some pretty opulent plans there, and I'm glad that's been toned down.
Did you have a comment?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, we're building a production facility. That's what comes first, is fish for the interior. You're asking the representative of the senators from the interior will tell you exactly the same thing. Now, discussions that may or may not happen between the mayor and other people, that's an interior discussion they can discuss. But I tell you, when you go up there, what I want anglers to be able to do is I want them to have the fish need now, as well as into the future. That's what you're getting from us. And that's the guarantee you want from us. After 25 years work for the department in this division, I understand who pays my bills, I understand what's necessary, and you know, that's a commitment you have out of us. And I'm sure, you know, Representative Kelly, Representative Holm will give you 100%. If you don't have fish, you don't have a hatchery, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. We'll go on here to Representative Jewell, but I just wanted to remind folks we are discussing amendment to the amendment. I've given quite a bit of latitude here because I think it's all relative, but... Okay, Representative.
Just before we vote, and strictly to the amendment on the amendment, I thought what I heard Representative Croft attempt to do was to keep the two-bit problem, changing the pocket problem that we're trying to solve, and at the same time on the person that goes to Safeway and just writes a check or whatever to buy a license with Fred Meyer or something, that recognize that not raise that one, I think is what I heard. And I had been the one originally trying to get this down a bit through an amendment that I didn't offer, the 750. Am I hearing that right?
Well, the amendment as it stands takes the resident 850 and makes it 8, and puts the primary non-resident license to one day from 850.
Point of order, we're talking about the amendment to the amendment, which takes it to 9.
To 9.
And I objected to the amendment because I'd rather keep it at 8 than 9. It's just in terms of background on...
Yes. Representative Kelly, gentlemen. We'll go on here. Representative Shaw, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just kind of roughly ran the numbers. And if we accept the amendment to the amendment, it takes the number to $2.584 million, which is $247,141. More than what the original proposal is at 850.
That's a big difference.
I only put in the four issues and also the three issues, the first three. And also, there won't be non-resident sports fishing. And we've got 2.47 million.
Mr. Mitchell, have you had a chance to run the numbers?
There's the
no.
Okay. Yeah, just trying to put everything in mind.
Okay. Chairman, while they're running numbers, can I speak to this issue just slightly? Okay. Because we talked about it a little bit earlier. Representative Croft made a point, and I think we're getting a little bit off target here. I know the concern about the dollar number, whether the dollar is $8 or $9. So I guess we could make the concern could be that whether or not the sport fisherman would rather pay $9 or $8. It's our, and I talked to Senator Seekins about it, it's our understanding that at $8 it doesn't work the way we envision it to work and the way it's been initially projected to work. If it had to go out 22 years or 25 years, it's a different issue than where we are today. And secondly, I think one of the problems that we're forgetting here is it really doesn't matter much how many dollars there is at the conception of this project. What matters is that there's enough to do the project. If we get some extra, the language in the bill says if you have extra money, you pay down the bonding early. That's all it does. So it doesn't, you're going to pay for it up front. The first few years, you're going to pay for it up front, but it will just pay it off earlier. So you may have, instead of a 15-year note, you may have a 14.6-year note or whatever it is. And if and that's the only thing that I see is what this does, but what it does, it provides the upfront money so we can do it. And I would suggest, too, that it's very rare in this day and age that we have a project that comes in at $2.6 million, but the state projects that it is, and it comes in under. So... just leaving it. Can you believe that? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative
Stone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Clarification to the amendment to the amendment. On line 29, is it the intent to leave the dollar amount at $10?
Yes.
Okay, so that was a discrepancy in money, so it was about $250,000.
$250,000.
You
keep wanting to say
$200 million.
That's close. Keeps making me nervous.
Moving decimals.
Okay. Any other comments on the to the amendment? And if I understand correctly, I think we are only dealing with lines 23, 24, 25, and 29. There was no friendly amendment to accept lines 1 and 2 on page 4. I think Representative Croft spoke to that.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no other discussion. There was an objection.
There were three objections.
Three objections, okay. That should be enough to warrant a roll call. Madam Clerk?
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Poffman?
Yes.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative Jewell?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Stoltz?
No.
Representative Weirach?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
And Representative Schnell?
No.
6 in favor and 5 against.
Okay, the amendment to the amendment passes. We now have the bill back to force as amended. Any other amendments? Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Let's move on.
I thought we amended the amendment number 2. We need to adopt amendment 2.
Oh, you're right. Thank you, Mr. Barber. We now have before us amendment 2 as amended. Thank you, Mr. Barber. Okay, is there any objection to amendment 2 as amended?
Okay.
There's an objection. Any more discussion? Amendment 2 as amended. Seeing none, Madam Secretary. Yes.
Yes.
Pass.
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Stoltz?
No.
Representative Weirach?
Yes.
Representative Croft?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
Representative Jewell?
Yes.
10 in favor, 2 against.
How do we work that out? We're picking the members. Okay, amendment 2 as amended passes. So we now have the bill back to force as amended. Any more discussion? Okay.
I guess I'll just...
Go ahead, Representative Stoltz.
Before somebody makes a motion to move it out, I just hope if this goes in, there's some increased angler opportunities in the Susitna Dreams, just because we've gotten pretty sorry treatment, not all due to fish hatchery availability. And I was hoping the commissioner would be here, the unconfirmed commissioner, to discuss some of these issues. And I sure would have liked to have talked about all fish and game fund issues and other commitments to the department, but... Absent that, I know, you know I have a lot of respect for Mr. Hepler and his stewardship of his division. I may not like this particular proposal, but I appreciate efforts, often unsuccessful, you make on behalf of sport fishermen. So, thank you.
Okay. Comment? Yes.
To the chair, Representative Stoltz, I did call the commissioner after a conversation. I know you'd like to have the commissioner here. He's in an emergency board meeting. He apologized, and he said he certainly would avail himself anytime. He'd like to have a conversation with you and have those conversations. So I appreciate your comments. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to present an opposing view from a member of the committee. I particularly commend the department's initiative and efforts in dealing with the changing circumstances in the hatcheries at Delmendorf, Fort Rich, that truly are beyond our control. Critical facilities. They've been doing a tremendous job, I believe, in operating in the aquaculture environment here, particularly your willingness to accommodate the needs and desires of Fairbanks to participate in an aquaculture program here. And again, I'm just, needless to say, I'm just kind of a, I'm a guy that likes fish hatcheries. And I really appreciate the bill coming forward, your support for it, and your department's support for that over the summer, getting me comfortable with what you all were doing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to dovetail on top of Representative Hocker as well. The Department of Fish and Game has been very supportive of me and getting this bill in, Senator Seekins, and we're very, very pleased that you've worked so hard on this. I know this has been a struggle for a good period of time, so thank you so much for all your hard work and build it within budget.
We have to.
Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Representative Holmes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move out CS for Senate Bill 147 with new fiscal note and appropriate. What I want.
Individual
recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Any objections? Seeing none, the bill passes the committee. Thanks, Senator Seekins.
Senator.
Senator.
Okay. I will take up Bill 16. Cars and duties, DOT, transportation. Senator Seekins. Okay. See, hold on just a second.
Sure.
Okay. We have Doug Rich.
Yes.
And Jeff Hoxie. Okay. Doug, go ahead. You're representing Senator Stevens.
That is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon for the record. My name is Doug Rich, aide to Senator Gary Stevens, who had another committee hearing going on today. Pleased to bring before you today SB 16. This is an effort that we've been working on with the department to update obsolete statutes related to the powers and duties of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The key provision in this bill for us is the removal of a burdensome requirement that the department conduct a cost-benefits analysis for all projects. This regulation has placed the department at a huge disadvantage because it makes every project, no matter how small, subject to a cost-benefit analysis, and as some of you may know, this provision has been used by opponents of DOT PF projects as a basis of litigation intended to stop those projects that are vital to safety and economic well-being of our citizens, and that does significantly increase project costs. Some of the bill's other provisions amount to some housekeeping measures, and as Chairman Myers mentioned, Jeff Otteson from the department is here to also talk about this bill, and he can answer specific questions you may have and go over some of the measures of the bill in greater detail than I can.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thank you. Lutz. Is there any questions for Mr. Lutz before we go on? Mr. Austin? Go ahead, Mr.
I guess that having heard a little bit, just a little about this bill, I expected to see you asking that we not have a cost-benefit study for small projects, but the more I look at it, it's eliminating it completely. Wouldn't it be appropriate on very big, medium to big size, let's say, projects that we have some consideration of the cost benefit? I could see why it'd be burdensome the smaller the project got, but why eliminate it totally?
I'd prefer to defer that question to Mr. Otteson.
Why don't we hold the question? We'll go on to Mr. Otteson's testimony and then question. Mr. Otteson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Meyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development at Department of Transportation, and I will cover the question as I go through my short briefing. There's a fairly detailed package from the department in your packet. I hope to paraphrase it and keep it right down to the essence of the essence of this time of the year. The bill has four sections. Half of those sections, four of them, are housekeeping. and they're shown in gray in the packet from DOT. The other four sections are a bit more substantive, and I'll try to give you the highlights of those four sections. Section one essentially would grant the department the ability to issue grants when those grants have been authorized by appropriation of the legislature. And why this is important is that we currently receive money in at least three different categories from federal sources that is then granted out to nonprofits and local governments. And we currently don't have that legal authority to be issuing those grants. So we're sort of at impasse between the law and the money we're receiving. The three areas are, are transit funds, scenic byways funds, and highway safety funds. Section 3 is also where there's some substance. This is where the old cost-benefit language was found that was so burdensome. It applies to every project, no matter how small. It applies to classes of projects where doing a cost-benefit analysis is essentially nonsensical. And how we resolve that is Section 3 takes that universal requirement out, but a later section, which you'll see in a moment, does add it back in for certain categories of projects. Section 5, which is also substantive, adds a new cost-effectiveness requirement for projects that are new in nature, that is, they're on new alignment, they're a new feature, and are not local in character. So they have to be both new and not local. This essentially would eliminate this burdensome requirement from about 80 to 90% of our projects, but those that are significant in nature, that are basically committing the state to building something new, and are not a local road in a local town, that type of project, are still exempted from the requirement. The other key words here is a cost-effectiveness analysis. This is a less complex, less mathematically complex type of analysis and can be done at lower cost than the more traditional cost-benefit analysis, which is very data-intensive. The final section that is of substance is Section 8. Section 8 simply gives us 1 year to take Section 5 and put it into regulation so that we have some rules to follow as we begin to implement Section 5. The department supports the legislation, as you probably gather. We have a lot of our statutes here regarding powers and duties are nearly 30 years old. There's been a lot of change over time that have made some of those statutes irrelevant or are just inapplicable, and we think the new change would be good for local government and good for the department. And with that, I'll go to questions if you have any.
Thank you, Representative Croft.
Well, I can see why it'd be good for the department and good for the government. I'm not sure I yet see how it'd be good for our oversight or the public. So did I understand you that what I thought was taken out totally is put back in for 10 to 20% of the projects? Where is that?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, is put back into Section 5. The new section is added, subparagraph E, to 44-42-050, that requires a cost-effectiveness analysis when evaluating new highways, airports, terminals, ferries, and other major components for inclusion in the plan. It excludes that same analysis for projects that involve rehabilitation and maintenance of the existing system, or that primarily serve local transportation needs.
Okay, that makes some sense. So there's the major projects, it seems like, back in. We were distinguishing for a while based on the size of the project. Why the local exemption, if you will? Why wouldn't you still want a cost-benefit analysis just because something can be characterized as local? I understand the major versus minor, you know, big money versus a small thing, minor bus. Well, tell me a little more about why we shouldn't have any cost-benefit analysis of something that can be termed local transportation.
Through the chair, Representative Croft, the requirement was actually following the heaviest in local government. They come to us basically with the nominations. From our standpoint, it kind of comes out of the blue. It has not been underway in our planning processes. It's not been identified by staff. We're geared up. We have transportation planners. We have economists on contract. We can do these studies fairly easily. But when local governments and villages come to us, it's often almost the back of an envelope kind of nomination. Right now, the way the statute is structured, they have to have that cost-benefit analysis in hand before it comes to us, or we have to reject it. And so the burden is very heavy. And when a project is local in nature, it tends to be small, it tends to be serving traffic within the community, to the school, to the dock. It's not the kind of commitment that on that basis alone we're going to turn it down on its costs. We may turn it down because we have more project nominations than we have funding, but those are the types of projects in general we want to support.
I see that. It seems like the back of an envelope budget might be the very one I'd like to have somebody do a cost-benefit analysis on.
Well, to elaborate, this is a cost-benefit analysis at the planning stage. This might be 20 years before the project actually gets funded. It's very early in the cycle of putting, this is a 20-year plan we're being asked by the statute to craft. Data is sparse. Our real knowledge of what the project will serve at that point in time is fairly de minimis. Almost every project, as it moves through the cycle, starts to get into detailed design. The quality of data goes up. You know its cost with a much greater degree of certainty. You know the number of people that it's going to serve. If it's a road in a larger community, you've sized that facility. You've selected the number of lanes needed to serve the public. The quality of information is going way up. And that's the time where some kind of cost study becomes much more meaningful. But 20 years out, quite frankly, we're dealing with WACs.
Well, why isn't that the answer then? Have the cost-benefit study only for big stuff and later? Is that on those that you do early on, the big project, major highway reconstruction, when you firm up the numbers, do you do it again, kind of? Or?
Yes, you essentially are doing it twice. This is a planning statute. This is the statute that speaks to how DOT conducts transportation planning. It's not a statute that talks about how we actually design and engineer a project.
So even those, and thank you for this, Mike, even those local transportation needs that are exempt from the planning stage cost-effectiveness analysis will at some later stage get something similar to it?
If they're on an order of magnitude that they deserve it. We get projects that range from, I need a senior van for the senior center.
Right.
We think those deserve to be exempted. We also get projects that are for $15 or $20 million new arterials through, you know, 10 miles of undeveloped terrain. Those projects have a full EIS, and almost invariably in the EIS process, there will be a cost-benefit analysis.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The letter that talked about the bridge on Dalton that a couple years ago, if I recall, we were trying to have this, we had this same problem and had it through State Affairs and through the Transportation Committee last session. Does this solve that problem now? Will this, in your opinion, will this solve the problem with having to go back and make these cost-benefit analyses when they really have no merit or in the DOT?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, yes, I believe it does. In fact, that project in question, the Ileana non-Dalton project, would still require a cost-benefit analysis. But we'll know that now. Bad on us. We didn't know it last time, and we let it go forward. And I would like to add for the record, the delay in this bill, and it wasn't your committee, you sponsored it last time, it is unfortunate. Three young men crashed through the ice this winter in January. Two of those young men died because that bridge was not built. So there's been a real human tragedy here because of this statute being on the books and causing problems for DOT. And I know, I'll be honest, it hit a lot of people very hard. It hit people in my community very hard. It hit people at DOT very hard to see that happen. But that's the kind of thing right now. We essentially have a club over our head. To give you one example of what happens without this language being changed, the Garvey bill that you are also, this committee is sponsoring, many of those projects have not gone through the DOT planning process, and we will need to start immediately to do those cost-benefit studies unless the statute's changed. Mm-hmm. But those projects, too, will be at risk.
Well, thank you very much for your support in this, Mr. Addison.
Any other questions? Representative Faulkner.
Yes, sir.
Representative Hawker.
Let's see, this is, I believe, let me get the right number here. Good meeting, sir. Would like to move from committee substitute, the spot for substitute for Senate Bill 16, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. I believe these are zero fiscal notes.
That is correct. Are there any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 16 was moved out of committee. Next, we will move on to SB 139, Occupational Boards and Agencies. That's what I had on my schedule. Good afternoon. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat Davidson. My name is Tom Maher. I'm with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, Gene Terrio Chair. With me is Pat Davidson, who you know as the Legislative Auditor. On the behalf of Senator Terrio and the LBNE Committee, I thank the House Finance Committee for hearing Senate Bill 139 relating to the termination and oversight of boards, commissions, and agency programs and extending the termination date of the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. This legislation stems from recommendations contained in two reports by the Division of Legislative Audit. From the sunset audit of the Board of Marital and Family Therapy, Section 1 of this bill extends the sunset date of the Board of Marital and Family Therapy from June 30th, 2005 to June 30th, 2010, per the audit recommendation contained in the report on page 9. I'd like to note for members that the auditors recommended two different extension dates for this board. If the Board of Marital and Family Therapy was consolidated with the Board of Professional Counselors, the auditors recommended a four-year extension. If the boards were not consolidated, then each should have a five-year extension, and that is what this legislation does for the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. There were a number of reasons a consolidation was not done at this time. While the Board of Marital and Family Therapy was in favor of the consolidation, the Board of Professional Counselors was strongly opposed and viewed the consolidation as burdensome on a volunteer board. Also, upon introduction of this bill, legislation had already been introduced in this body that extended the Board of Professional Counselors for 5 years. While we appreciate the options presented to us by Legislative Audit, we believe the five-year extension is currently the best option. If two volunteer boards are consolidated with one board vehemently opposing that action, the outcome may not be as positive as we would like. Senate Bill 139 also incorporates recommendations contained in the audit of the Alaska Sunset Process and selected investigative issues. First, in Senate Bill 139, Sections 2 and 3 changed the standard sunset period for occupational boards in AS0803020C and non-occupational boards in AS4466010C from not to exceed 4 years to not to exceed 8 years. Increasing the standard sunset period allows for better use of audit staff committee time and makes the sunset process less consuming for boards, regulatory agencies, and such. As Alaska's sunset process has matured, most of the sunset reviews are less about eliminating board and commissions and more about operational performance. 12 states have either repealed or suspended their sunset process. The most common standard extension is 10 years, while Alaska, along with three other states, have maintained a standard for a four-year extension. Of course, the legislature will still be able to set whatever time extensions it deems appropriate, regardless of the statutory change. Second, to focus attention on operational performance, this legislation will require specific analysis of efficiency and effectiveness and the avoidance of duplication of functions during the sunset review process. In Section 4, two criteria are added to the statute that must be considered in the course of a sunset review. First, the extent to which the board, commission, or agency has effectively attained its objectives and efficiency with which it has operated. And second, the extent to which the board, commission, or agency duplicates the activities of another governmental agency or the private sector. Expanding the criteria will assure that the auditors will measure the efficiency and effectiveness of boards, commissions, or the agencies under review. The House and Labor Commerce Committee deleted two sections from this bill that dealt with boards that are terminated and clarifying the transfer of responsibility for regulatory and disciplinary powers to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. While the department has assumed this responsibility for administering the regulated occupation after a board is terminated, the statutes do not clearly give the department the authority to do so. These two sections, in our opinion, would help address this uncertainty, and I do have a blank amendment if members want to discuss adding those back. Finally, there was a fiscal note from occupational licensing. Passage of this legislation will incur no additional cost, and the outline of fiscal year shown on the fiscal note merely show the cost of continuing this board at the current level already included in the budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Both Pat Davidson and myself are here, and I think we have the Director of Occupational Licensing for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Parker.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Yes, Tom, Pat, on the criteria for adding to sunset reviews, number 11, the extent to which a board commission can duplicate activities, either another government or private sector agency. That's just such, you know, obvious common sense. Makes me wonder why we won't add it now. Seems pretty objective. Before I'm looking at number 10, however, is making judgment calls on the effectiveness and efficiency. That's got to be a little bit difficult. I just wonder if you could comment on how you would measure effectiveness and efficiency.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, not only are these adding criteria for us when we conduct the audit, it's also telling the board, commission, and their agency how they are going to be evaluated. As the ideas of missions and measures, looking at outcomes, we want to make sure that those ideas are being brought to the boards and commissions and agencies. As you look at many of the sunsets, which are occupational boards, there's a way to look at efficiency. There's a way to look at effectiveness. They're to some degree already part and parcel in a lot of the other criteria, that idea of efficiency, but it doesn't say it specifically. An example would be, from an efficiency standpoint, how many board meetings does it take the board to be able to completely review an applicant's application for licensure? If it takes more than one, you ought to be looking at what those processes are. But this also is going to address non-occupational agencies. We're going to be looking, when we look at the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, which is one of the councils under the sunset provisions. I think that will bring that, the tone of those things, into all of the boards and commissions that are under sunset.
So, as far as setting the criteria for, and I don't want to pick on CDBSA, but just a hypothetical XYZ alphabet soup board commission activity that's going to be reviewed, who will be sort of the setting those missions and major standards that you'll be measuring against? Are you going to be creating those yourself, or will the board of commission itself establish those, or is that something that you'll have legislative guidance to set those benchmark criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I would say, similar to many performance audits, the first thing that we do in the planning process for the audit is we go looking for best practices. Many of these are not Alaska-only organizations. Many types of these organizations have been through review processes. So the first thing that we do is we take a look at what are best practices for an entity or an organization. Secondly, if they have missions, measures, outcomes, we're going to be building on those. And matters of efficiency and effectiveness, just also through observation during the course of an audit, in terms of how long does it take them to get something done.
Thank you. You're comfortable with this language?
To Through the chair, Representative Hocker, yes, I am.
Maybe I'll ask one more question.
Have you heard of Hocker?
Feedback from the boards and commissions on whether they're happy with this language.
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, no, we haven't heard anything from the boards.
Not until we pass it. Thank you.
Any other questions? It's not our intent to move this today, so is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify? Rick, would you?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. I'm here today to testify in favor of the bill on behalf of the Board of Marriage, Home, Family Therapy. We certainly want that board extended. But more importantly, I'm here in favor of an amendment. In the last committee, they dropped off a couple provisions, as you just heard about. There were sort of generic provisions as to what happens when a board is in fact sunset. There is nothing in the law now that says what happens when a board sunsets. It's important to understand the law does not go away. The licensing law does not go away in our case. Those are still on the books. And proposed amendment will put that duty on us and give us time to work with the auditors and the legislature to formulate however you best want to regulate whatever that profession may be. And we do have a board that is being sunset on June 30th of this year. So it's most important that these provisions be put in this session.
Is that all you have?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I would suggest then, Rick, that you work with the sponsor and have them bring us the amendment, and we will look at it when we bring this bill up again and bring an amendment for the finance group.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you. Next, we will move on to SJR 11. We'll take a brief introduction. Hey, Chuck. Chuck, if you'd like to state your name for the record, and I guess you're going to present SJR 11.
For the record, my name is Chuck Carlmert. I'm with the Alaska Department of Revenue, and I don't know how to describe this, but I'm obviously not the
there
sponsor.
We go.
Oh, there we are.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, are we on SJR 11?
Yes, we are, sir.
I'm fresh from the Resources Committee, so let me clear my mind for a moment. I was just talking about a resolution with regard to hunting and fishing. My name is Dave Stancliffe. I'm staff to Senator Terrio. And the resolution before you deals with a tax on talking. It's the most interesting, piece of federal law in that it's been repealed twice. It was put in 1898, which happens to be the year my father was born. As a luxury tax to help pay for the war going on at that time. Basically, it was repealed, put into a repeal at one time and or into the budget bill, and Senator or President Clinton refused to repeal the tax. It's a tax that affects everyone who picks up the phone and talks. It's a tax that's been up and down and all around, and this resolution merely asks that it finally die a very natural death and go away. I provided in the packet some of the more, I guess, salient points. 94 million American households currently pay the 3% tax. It disproportionately affects seniors on fixed incomes as well as small and minority-owned businesses. This is not a tax cut for the rich. While there are 105 million households in America, more than 99 million of them have telephones, so 94% of the American households will get some sense of relief. Here in Alaska, it's approximately $17 million, I believe, is the effect of this tax in communications. There is some concern that it will be used as a vehicle to originate tax movement toward the internet. And it's timely, I guess, because it's a tax that has outlived its usefulness. If there are any specific questions, I could give you more of the details, but I'm sure at this late hour you may not want those.
Should I start? I see you have a zero fiscal note here. I'm just curious, are you sure that we've actually paid off all our debts from the Spanish-American War?
Mr. Chairman, I would be willing to bet a good sum of money that we probably have.
I also noticed in here in the fiscal note, you estimate that $17 million a year paid by Alaska taxpayers to for federal telecommunications taxes?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that note, the state of Alaska, does it not pay any federal excise tax? Does it not pay this tax, the state itself, for its telephones and telephone service?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, that as often is the case, public institutions are exempt. This is a tax on your constituents.
So we don't, when we pay our phone bills, we don't have it?
You won't find it on the legislative phone bill, no, sir.
Yeah, right. Good to know.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, sir. I wasn't calling for attention, but as long as you've recognized me, I'll be we're going to take this away and kind of reverse frame revenue from the federal budget, and there's obviously going to be a big chunk in the federal budget for this. What will that consequence be? I suspect they probably got to make up from it. Make it up somewhere to pay for, it's not Spanish-American War, it's probably the issues that are going on in the Middle East today. I'm kind of curious what, you know, we seem to be coming in here and saying, we don't like taxes. I don't like taxes. I don't think anybody does. But what's the consequence if the federal government, you know, if they do repeal this telecommunications tax?
Mr. Chairman, one of two things will happen. There'll be some cuts in some areas to offset that reduction in revenue, or there will be new sources of revenue that will, I guess, be discovered. The good news is that Alaska doesn't benefit directly from this tax in that it's not dedicated or put back into Alaska services. It goes into what we would call the general fund, the treasury.
My follow-up is, do we run a risk if option B is followed and they find something else to tax, that could be more onerous than the tax this year, the devil we know versus the devil we know?
Mr. Chairman, I think that that is always a real risk. I think the question is whether you feel this type of tax is burdensome to your constituents, and maybe there's a better form of tax out there, whoever knows what that might be. This is just a straight policy call.
Would you entertain an amendment to add the federal income tax to this?
Just a thought.
If you carry it on the floor.
Representative Weirach.
Just a quick question. It says in line 11 to 13, the internet and other technologies depend on telecommunications, so the excise tax discourages expansion. Well, since 1898, we've had a huge expansion in the telecommunications industry, cell phones, telecommunications through the internet. What do you call it? The fiber optic cable technology, on and on and on. And so how is the excise tax discouraging expansion? To me, it belies the fact.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this particular perspective is basically based on the fact that this money doesn't necessarily go back into expansion of those facilities. Undoubtedly, huge strides have been made. And perhaps if this was poured back into that, it would there'd be a better argument for maybe maintaining it. I think if you talk to any of your constituents, they wonder about their phone bills and all the mysterious things they pay, and those things have increased. Again, I think it comes back to there's no guarantee that the tax that's being levied for talking is actually going back into making talking easier.
Representative Stoltz.
I guess since everybody's piling on, even though it is just a resolution, I don't want to take this overly serious. This was a slam dunk in Congress, as I remember the last time. I think there were two members of the House of Representatives, he's pejorative. There was a member from California, and I think a member from Chicago were the only two in the House, and it was a similar, it wasn't even a close call in Congress. Is that your memory?
I don't have anything in writing, but yes, I've heard that verbally, that this is not a controversial item.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Foster.
I'll go ahead and move out SJR 11 out of committee with the attached list and also the individual recommendations.
Are there any objections?
I wanted to thank the person chairing this bill. I thought it was a very good professional presentation. I'm always odd when he's here.
You're always in awe when he's here.
Oh, yeah.
If there are no objections, we'll move the bill out of committee, and since we're apparently still waiting on information, we will stand in recess to a call of the chair.
Thank you, Mr.
With
Chair.
With that, we're in recess.
Also, for the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Co-Chairman Schnell, Representative Hawker, Representative Jewell, and attendance Burton. Okay, so we have the revised fiscal note before us, and it's been objected to so we can hear it and understand it. Ms. Milhorn, it's my understanding you'll explain the fiscal.
For the record, my name is Melanie Melhorn, and I'm the director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Thank you. So the fiscal note before the members right now is the fiscal cost that the division anticipates will accompany the new DC defined contribution plan. And we have received information from our tax attorney with Deloitte that indicates that all costs associated with the defined contribution plan must be separated and accounted for in various different funds according to their components, and they must be separated from the assets and the accounting under the defined benefit plan. So that's why this fiscal note request startup costs in order to implement the new defined contribution plan, and they must be separate.
Do you have any questions for Ms. Miller?
Yeah.
President Croft?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for being late. We're assembling, I assume, the statutorily required backup data for SB 141.
That's correct.
And is this one going to take to be it? What was put on our desks?
Yes. Ms. Milhorn described that this note number 10, as well as the Mercer graphs. Was there anything else that we should have before us, Ms. Milhorn?
No.
Okay.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Sure. Go ahead. Sure.
Are the 5% that we are setting aside in the defined contribution plan for people to retire on going to be sufficient for them to retire on?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Croft, there were some modeling that accompanied the tier redesign plan, and in that particular build-up, what you find, actually, I don't know if you have received a copy of this presentation material. Okay.
One time. Sure.
I think all the members did receive it.
Okay. Then I would refer you to slide number 74.
In case not everybody has it, you can explain what slide 74 is.
Slide number 74 is titled Proposed Alternatives, and it's the accrual of non-medical benefits. So this is the DB component, and this includes some assumptions down at the bottom. And if you look at the slide, what that is an individual who comes into the system at age 40. And this is a buildup of assets under their defined contribution plan. And you would want to look at alternative number 2. And when you look at alternative number 2, which did not, this is, the 5% is a higher amount than what this modeling depicts.
Because that was based on 4.5?
Actually, let me take a look here, just one moment.
Well, we have a pause here. For the record, we have Representative Croft just joined us, and Representative Schultz. Go ahead.
What the tier design looked at is actually a DB component that was 3.5%. So this is now in-house finance, and the adoption was at 5%. So this buildup of assets under this scenario includes 3.5. And what you can see is that an individual who enters the system at age 40 under alternative 2 actually has a much higher benefit up and until that line segments about age 55. So what you're comparing against is the current tier 2 for TERS, which is the bottom line, and you can see that there's a margin between the alternative 2, so there's additional assets is the difference between the alternative 2 line.
Until what age? What's the break point?
The break point is about age 55. So during that 15-year period, essentially, an individual would have a higher benefit accumulation. And this is under a 3.5 accumulator, not a 5%. So 5% would be even higher.
Do you and have the numbers on the... Because we have 5% on our bills. Do you have a similar graph for a 5% plan?
No, we have not grafted that right now. Mercer would have to recalculate what that benefit accumulator is.
Okay.
And the average years of service for TERS is approximately 10 years. So what you can see is that for perhaps almost 80% of your population, you have a higher benefit level under TERS for the average member.
And how does that break down the... Averages can be difficult. The average wage of a North Carolina geology major is $1 million, but that's just because Michael Jordan was a geology major at North Carolina. It doesn't mean that they make an average of $1 million. So how does it break down on the 5% plan that we have for low-paid employees versus high? You see what I mean? You've stated what the average is. Is it that compared to our current plan, our secretaries and janitors are going to be much worse off, but our highest employees are going to be much better off? Is it the opposite? You've told me the average. How does it work out for the lowest and highest paid employees?
That 5%, through the chair, that 5% would be a 5% based on their salary. So that amount would go into their defined contribution plan.
Yeah, but how did the two plans compare? You've done it on the average. For mm-hmm. What's the spread? What would that graph look like on a 5% compared for a low-level employee versus a highly paid? Would it look exactly identically?
Well, this graph, through the chair, Representative Croft, this graph is based on an individual coming in at age 40, and it has... a salary component and some calculations down at the bottom. So this is based on these set of assumptions.
Right.
You'd need to graph that out for someone who is, say that their salary is $35,000 and what that amount would be, and then you would do that differently for an individual who...
What's the average salary on that? I apologize. What's the salary used for that?
This is an average salary of
$35,000, yeah.
Which is actually... lower than the average salary for PERS.
I'd be interested to get that run at whatever average you guys would like on the plan that we have before us at 5, and then something, you don't have to do a bunch, but something says, and at 20,000 it looks like this, and at 65 it looks like this, sort of frame it and figure out if there's a differential impact on our lowest and our highest paid employees. I know everyone wants to get to the floor. Let me ask about the death and disability benefit that we added by amendment. What do you estimate the cost of that to be, and where would the money come from?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, that has not been completely costed at this point in time. When I testified on Sunday, the reason I said that was problematic is because it's unfunded. At this point, there was not anything that was built into that component piece. I expect that we can get those costs fairly soon.
Okay, can you give me some rough estimate? Because we can't assess people's individual defined contribution accounts for this. I mean, we can't reach into somebody's medical account or HRA or retirement. So can you give me a rough estimate of how much this will cost in general funds? And is it general funds, or where else might it come from?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, it's anticipated that once those costs are known, that it would be placed in the medical benefit portion. So right now, the medical component is, the costing associated with that is somewhere between 2.5 and 3.75. That's estimated by Mercer right now. No, the contribution.
Oh, the contribution.
The contribution amount for the employer. Now, in addition to that, there is going to be a death and disability amount that will need to be costed, and that would be included on top of what the medical costs are.
Okay, is it more like 100,000, more like a million, or more like 10 million? Just so I can get an idea. Per year in general funds or whatever we, I want to get the order of magnitude of how much this will cost, and we're going to have to find some source for the money, but is it more like a million or more like two?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, I have not had an opportunity to get definitive costing from Mercer right now. Mercer is aware that the House finance members have included this in their bill provision, so they are going to be providing us with a cost, but I'm not comfortable giving you between two different numbers when I'm not sure what that amount would be.
Okay, and the last one on that, and then so we have a death and disability benefit. And it was done, it was an appropriate one, and the support, it was done conceptually. If four firefighters go into a building and don't come out because it collapses on that, I mean, you sort of have to buy insurance that would estimate some years you won't have any claims, and some years you might have a big disaster that takes a lot. If those are municipal firefighters, is it the municipality or us that's on the hook? That is, I couldn't sort of tell from the amendment whether we meant we will pay a benefit or they will. And because we don't have a funding source now, if those aren't state firefighters but instead municipal, is it that huge liability that just got incurred to the employer, where does it go?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, if I understand your question properly, the proposal by Representative Kelly would have had a fixed benefit where the individual, it would have been $500,000 or $250,000, and we knew what those costs were associated with that, and that was for police and firefighter members.
Well, that's not what we ended up doing.
Right, but correct.
Even with that approach, you don't know how many are going to die each year. I mean, that's a more set amount, but if it's zero, there's mm-hmm. zero assessment. If there's four, it's a $2 million chunk that comes in. But the more general question under either approach, but specifically under what we did, who gets that bill? The municipality of Anchorage or the state of Alaska if it's a municipal firefighter?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, it would be... It would be expected that those costs under Representative Kelly's amendment would be to the employers. The employers would pick up the overall cost for that benefit. So if it was a member of the municipality of Anchorage, then the employer is paying for that cost should police and firefighter member perish.
And under the current amendment that we have in the current bill, it's the same situation. It's tied to the employer relationship.
That's correct, except there's not a funding source under the House Finance amendment. And we need to find out and determine exactly what those costs are going to be.
When do you expect you'll be able to answer that question?
I'm hoping I would be able to have that answer tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Rick McCroft. Any other questions? Seeing none. Representative Schnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion to report the bill out with attached revised fiscal note with the accompanying Mercer letter and the grant.
Any objections?
I'll object.
Okay. And let's see. Yes. Okay.
I'll remove my motion.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. The original motion was to move
to adopt the revised fiscal note number 10 for SB 141, which includes the letter from Mercer and accompanying draft.
Okay.
That was objected by Representative Jewell.
And I'll go ahead and remove my objection.
Okay. Objection is removed.
The motion is to adopt these pages and somehow include them with the bill. That's fine.
That's the second. That's his next motion. Yes.
Yep.
Do you want to make that motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would make a motion to report the bill out of committee with the attached revised fiscal note, along with the accompanying Mercer letter and grants.
No, object to that.
There's an objection to that motion. Any other discussion?
Just very briefly, because we've had a lot. The law that we ran into today, and I've never seen before today, there shall be attached to the bill an analysis of the long-term and short-term cost to the state. We just heard here today, we can't estimate within $1 million what this obligation on death and disability, a very appropriate obligation for the state to have, will cost. We're about to advance out of the Finance Committee. It was one of the points of this law so long ago, and we don't, if they ask us, our individual constituents or the news reporters, how much does this cost, we can't tell them. It's the very thing that this was designed to prevent. Ms. Milhorn said that she expects numbers like that tomorrow. At least we ought to be able to stare people in the face and say, I know what it's going to cost. And we cannot now. I don't think we meet the statute, but more importantly, I don't think we do what a finance committee should when we report out a bill as important as this, not knowing its fiscal impact. Not even knowing, Mr. Chairman, what funding mechanism, we know we've got to fund it. We're gonna be obligated to fund it. We're going to say in statute to the possible, to the firefighters and police, we will provide this benefit, and we don't know now not only what it will be, but how, but where it's going to come.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I'd just like to remind the committee that there are a number of issues that we deal with every day that we have no idea what they cost us, and yet we budget for them, and one in particular would be in my area, the fire season. Fire season comes up, and all of a sudden we have a supplemental. That's what we have a supplemental program for. I do understand that this is a very great concern by all of us, and we want to make sure it's funded appropriately, and I think everybody wants to make sure it will be. But we certainly don't have any control over the cost of oil or the price of oil. We don't have any control over a number of issues in the state, so to try and tie our feet in the concrete and say that we know exactly and precisely how many dollars we're going to spend on a particular program, I think we many times are not even close to $1 million on a number of issues, so I don't know why we would be so terribly tied to this.
Thank you, Representative Holman. And we do pass out bills with indeterminate fiscal notes all the time.
Mr. Chairman, I respecting the question, I think there is an answer to that. It might not. It's more of a hilltop answer, but if what the amendment yesterday did is it reached over into the DB and it said things are just the same as they were. So I would argue there is no impact, no change from the current program, and then. So that sets the action yesterday in perspective, because we've already taken care of that. So we said these folks will be the same as they were. the Mercer letter then goes on to make it clear that under the very separately funded DC program, that the action is positive actuarially. And I think that puts in context the question of the amendment yesterday and the overall situation. So just trying to be to say we may have more of a grasp on that by far than your statement would indicate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just a short. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I just need to respond. I was done, but they're not paying it, the money. It puts them back in the DB system, but nobody's paying into that DB system anymore, and they aren't even. They're all in a defined contribution, and we're going to reach back and grab a DB benefit for somebody who dies in disabled. On what? And that's the very problem that Melanie was talking about. Nobody's paying into that system anymore. I mean, they're not. They're a new employee. And so how do you fund it? Of course, it's a slightly positive for the new DC system because those very few people pop out of it. But the point is they go someplace. The idea that there might be a positive fiscal impact from us guaranteeing this disability we know is wrong. There's going to be an additional fiscal impact. We don't know how big it is. We have no idea. And we have no idea who's going to pay for it given we've just opted them out of that old system. A new hire fireman is going to be getting a DC benefit and is going to pop back in to a DB plan if killed on the job. Funded by what? And you know, to say that we don't know the price of oil, we don't know where the fires are going to be, those are all true. But those are things that happen to us. This is about our responsibility to pass out things that we can even estimate. And that's why the statute was put there to say, don't make big changes to the retirement system if you can't even give me some number on it. We're violating the law if we pass this out, but set that aside. You've done an excellent job, Mr. Chairman, with your two-hearing rule and a lot of different things to make sure that what we do is defensible, appropriate. And this would not be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I read Alaska Statute 2408.036, which is the statute that this package purports to comply with, to be quite honest, I have very grave reservations that this complies with certainly either the substance or the intent of that statute. But one of the things that I've learned in this body the last 3 years is that the legislature can, at its will, circumvent the statute it imposes to regulate itself, as we can circumvent the rules of order that we choose to impose upon ourselves. There is no remedy for the public in this case. And that, I think, clearly the handwriting's on the wall. We're going to move this out. I don't think it sets a good precedent, and I'm quite troubled because, again, we don't have any idea what the consequences are going to be on our existing plan by eliminating its future source of funding completely by putting all the employees into a new plan. There's a lot of things that we don't know about. But again, it's the one nice thing about making the rules, we get to change them. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just very quickly, we know the dying rate of the group, both groups, and we know what it costs to cover that. So those figures are both the numbers that are associated with it and the cost of covering that. So it's something that can be very easily developed and provided. The difficulty we're up against here is kind of a good faith effort to respond to a request that we create the actuarial response and we respond as best we can. And I do believe that we've done that, and I also believe that the information is available and it's no change from what it's been costing us before. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Seeing no other people wanting to discuss this, the motion again is to pass out the bill with the attached revised fiscal note with the company Mercer letter and graphs. Do you maintain your objection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Holm.
Yes.
Representative Jewell.
No.
Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Representative Cox?
No.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Hopper?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
Representative Chenault?
Yes.
Okay.
The
bill passes out of committee. Hopefully, attached to the fiscal notes. That concludes our business.
Says that's been analysis of long short term cost of the state of the bill is adopted.
This is the public employees retirement system. This is our value. This is our employer contribution rate based on a 1% population increase and 8.2% investment return. That's what we know is going to happen.
He gave it to me, and I thought he'd maintain it. It's very serious.
There's the employer contribution rate right here. It'll go up, and this is what a new tier would do. The cost that is the tier we don't have, but it is expected that since this line is lost, but it is expected since that contribution line either stays the same or starts to go down.
I had to write down all the references and all the amendments just to keep track of it.
Under the existing system on here, under this so these figures would be less.
I literally was keeping track.
I can't give you exact. I can tell you it will be this, and it will be less.
My contention will be, I'm going to get on the floor just so you know the analysis.
But it will be
They're just putting pressure on now.
The way that that's addressed is structurally tied together. So when you look at the new tier introduction coming in, and those payroll dollars are not going toward the new tier for them, but what you do is you take the payroll dollars, say that they're $100 million, you take those dollars and you make a computation based on that service rate. The employer pays that, and it keeps this line going up and then starting to come down. So you use the dollars, but just for purposes of calculating what the past contribution rate needs to be. The normal cost rate is not. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I think so. In the 60s, and it's low.
My belly.
They're really warming it up. Fries are up.
You're asking about the current system.
Yep. Okay.
That's what I'm talking about. Right. Okay, so you've got payroll dollars to establish what your employer contribution rate is.